Prepare your ears, humans. Happy, Sad, Confused begins now.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Jim Gaffigan, from comedy to acting to balancing work and family. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Another first-timer on the pod this week, Mr. Jim Gaffigan. It doesn't get any bigger in the comedy world than Jim Gaffigan. He's one of the best and has been for quite some time. This is a great career conversation, another live event we taped in New York City, talking all things comedy, acting, and as I said, he's a consummate professional, but also a dedicated family man, and we gotta respect that. He's a good one, and it's a great chat. You're definitely going to enjoy. Before we get to the main event, though, as always, I want to keep you guys posted on live events, events just coming up in the Happy, Sad, Confused Josh Horowitz universe, ways to support, ways to be there in person or virtually. Here's what's coming up. I've been mentioning this for a while, but we are careening towards a big live event at 92NY, May 15th, John Cena, talking about the latest Fast and Furious movie. This is going to be a good one. John Cena, Peacemaker, the wrestling career, his comedic prowess, his action chops, the guy can do it all, and he's going to be a great returning guest on Happy, Sad, Confused. Get your tickets now, May 15th, live in New York City. There are tickets available for the virtual live option as well. That's the only official live event on the calendar right now, but, and this is a major but, I have two events, at least two, confirmed for June that will be big. So, this is a PSA, guys. If you've been considering the Patreon, and I know I mentioned the Patreon a lot, but let me just say, hear me out for a second. If you've been considering the Patreon, now might be a good time because what do you get with the Patreon? Depending on the level you're at, I mean, even at the lowest level, you get early access and discount codes. This will come in handy, guys, because there are a couple events coming up, one in particular, but all of them, frankly, that you will want to get in on early. You'll want to hear about early. You might want the discount as well. This, just never let it be said, I didn't give you a warning. Fair warning. We're going to announce these soon. Try the Patreon, patreon.com/happysadconfused. One of these events is going to sell out in a day, I guarantee it. The other one, I think, will also hopefully sell out, and you're going to want to get in on these very early. Those are just two of the events coming up in June. There are more afoot. I'm really, really excited about all of them, and I can't wait to say more. Other things to mention. Well, I'm off to L.A., very soon, because this is, as I have for many years now, part of the day job has been working with MTV, and I will be doing my thing. I will be hosting their red carpet extravaganza. It's Sunday, May 7th, live on MTV, the MTV Movie and TV Awards. I have such fond memories, not only growing up watching the MTV Movie Awards, but then having the place I've had the last 10, 15 years. Time flies when you're having fun, being kind of a guy for them on the carpet. It's a privilege every time they invite me back, and they have been foolish enough to invite me back again. So you'll be able to watch my red carpet chats as kind of interstitial breaks, I believe, in the 2 hours leading up into the live event. That's going to be awesome. And it's, by the way, the show is hosted by Drew Barrymore. I don't know who's been announced as presenter, so I'm not going to even say, but I can say that it's our best guest lineup in years, truly. And then I'll be doing my backstage thing. I'll be backstage talking to all the winners and presenters, and those will be fun for me because those are a little bit longer conversations than the stuff on the carpet. And they'll be rolling out, I'm sure, all over MTV and MTV News' socials. So stay tuned. Follow me, of course, on Joshua Horowitz, Twitter, Instagram, and I'll post all the stuff there, too. But I'm excited. this is it's an annual big event. And it's fun to not only do a big carpet, but to kind of have like the main position, like to be like kind of like where everybody stops. And we get such an eclectic, fun group of like the old guard, of course, the new guard, and I'm stoked. It's going to be great. Then I transition right into basically a couple days later, I'm heading off to Rome for the Fast and Furious X Fast 10. I keep saying it both ways. Red carpet. It's going to be bananas with that ginormous cast for that ginormous movie. Can't wait to bring you guys back some fun coverage from that one. And then we're just like, we're into it, guys, right? Summer movie season hits with all of them. I'm so excited for her. I haven't seen Guardians yet. That's about to come out, but I'm hearing amazing things. Fast, of course, Mission Impossible around the corner. Indiana Jones, I'm so excited. So lots of exciting stuff, lots of podcasts that are attached to all of these films. Stay tuned. Some big announcements on the way. So keeping busy. Hope you guys are too, but I hope you're also planning some summer getaways, some extended weekends, some rest and relaxation. I'm going to try and fit it in as well. Got to find the balance, guys, right? And that gives us a good segue to the main event. A man who has found balance somehow, Jim Gaffigan. As I said to Jim in this conversation, the two things that strike me about Jim Gaffigan following his career are his devotion to the career. The man is a workaholic. He is always on the road, churning out specials, acting, like has an amazing acting career too, and yet is also a father of five, a devoted husband, and clearly these are both important to him, and somehow he makes it work. He talks about how he does in this. This is a guy where kind of what you see is what you get. He is affable and charming and sweet and super funny. Just like one of those comedians. And I had a real fun time getting to know Jim. He was at 92NY to chat with me about the career, but also his latest film, actually, which is David Lowery's Peter Pan and Wendy, which I really enjoyed. Peter Pan and Wendy is on Disney Plus. Check it out. It is a retelling, of course, of the Peter Pan story. Jude Law is Captain Hook. It's one of the better retellings, I think. They every 5-6 years they give it another go, and there's a lot I really enjoyed in this one. Has actually like it has the most shades of Hook back in the day for any Peter Pan retelling in the last 30 years. So take that for what it's worth. If you loved Hook, there's definitely it reminded me a little bit of that. And that's a tough comparison. That's Steven Spielberg, obviously, right? But there's a lot to love in this rendition of Peter Pan, and David Lowery continues to be a fascinating filmmaker who I really should have on the podcast now that I think about it at some point. Just the balance between kind of the ain't them body saints side of his career, Old Man and the Gun, and then Pete's Dragon, and Peter Pan and Wendy, and The Green Knight. I mean, this guy kind of can do anything and everything, and he's interesting. Anyway, that'll be a conversation for another time, I'm sure. So I take you now to 92NY, one of our live events. I hope you guys enjoy this. I know you will. When you've got one of the funniest men on the planet, a professional funny man like Jim Gaffigan, satisfaction is guaranteed. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to Happy, Sad, Confused. Spread the good word. Give the Patreon a chance at patreon.com/happysadconfused. And enjoy me and Mr. Jim Gaffigan.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Oh, you're close by. I like the fact that he's that close.
You have the option. Oh, that was like a beautiful E.T. phone home moment.
That was very special. He's actually my son.
You're all Jim Gaffigan's children.
That's
in a way,
right?
Tonight.
This is what my apartment, this is why I left.
an official welcome again to all of you folks coming out tonight. This is a live taping of my podcast, Happy, Sad, Confused. And you know this gentleman. He is a
best-selling author, a brilliant stand-up, an amazing actor, a raconteur, Mr. Oh. Jim Gaffigan, one more time, officially.
Thank you.
And a New Yorker.
I've lived in New York for, I think, over 35 years.
How did a sweet Indiana boy end up in our scary city?
Have you been to Indiana? No, I always wanted to move to New York. I mean, I grew up watching The Odd Couple and seeing, you know, it just looked like there was a lot of energy there. And I love everything that I think people don't like about New York. I love the noise. I love the attitudes. I love all that. And I think I need the energy because even when I'm in the suburbs, I just fall asleep at 8 p.m.
Right, right. I'm a lifelong New Yorker, and I often say, yeah, like I feel like I would just like go into a cocoon anywhere else. I would not interact with anybody if I wasn't forced to on the streets of New York.
And I like the fact that I could walk outside at any time and get food. That's important.
Let's not underestimate that as a factor.
Right? That's key.
So we're going to do a little bit of a This Is Your Life, Jim Gaffigan tonight. But I want to start with a great new movie that Jim is in. Jim, you've quietly or not so quietly been accumulating this amazing acting career in addition to the stand-up career. And he's in this amazing new retelling of Peter Pan and Wendy. You are Smee, part of the iconography of the legend.
Yeah. Yeah.
How does this happen? How do you get involved?
I had done an indie film that was produced by David Lowry.
The director.
And I think he saw that. And one of the producers on that he works with was on set. And we were, and I kind of brought up, and I didn't even remember it at the time. I was like, what is David working on? He goes, well, he's going to be working on a new Peter Pan. And I'm like, oh, I could be Smee. And I totally had forgotten it until I got to Vancouver. And I was like, how'd you guys end up hiring me? And they're like, you told us. So I'm not that bright, but no? I'm pushy.
You felt, you felt there was an inner Smee within
you. Yeah, well, I mean, I think I would have been a really fantastic Wendy, but but I was like, all right, I could be Smee. Like, Hook, that sounds like a lot of work.
Right. Yeah. Hook is played by the delightfully talented and charismatic Mr. Jude Law.
Yes.
Now, do we resent Jude Law, who is obviously one of the most attractive human beings on the planet, and yet chooses often to be like, you know what, I'm going to just not be that for this?
He is a good-looking guy. And you know, that's reason enough to not like someone.
Yeah.
But he's also a great actor, and he's intelligent. And we spent a lot of time, like, if you see the movie, there's a lot of downtime on film sets anyway, but like we were in like a dinghy for like 3 of the weeks. And so there was, I had a lot of time with Jude Law, and he's very intelligent and thoughtful, and he's really, you know, had this incredible career. I dislike him more for his success than his looks.
Right. How would you define the Smee-Hook relationship?
Well, that's what was so fun about working with David Lowry is I can't think of a story that really, I mean, Little Mermaid, all these Disney stories are amazing, but I do think that there is an attachment we all feel to Peter Pan, and whether that's being a kid that doesn't want to go into eighth grade, or you don't want to grow up, or you look back and have nostalgia for when you were younger. But when I got to Vancouver and I spent some time, and also it was the pandemic, so there was a lot of Zooming going on, where we were talking about Smee and Hook, and so developing backstories for these classic characters and where some of that could come from. And so we created this backstory and some of it is maybe because I have 5 children, and as we all know, Hook is rather mean to Smee.
Right.
And how do we justify that? And they had the idea that, and I don't want to give anything away, but that Smee rescues Hook at some point. And I was like, oh, so Smee, the reason he receives this abuse constantly from Hook is because Smee is like a parental figure to Hook. And anyone who's lived with a teenager, you know, and or seen the way like a child might talk to a parent,
right?
There's some kind of justification for it. Now, there's some young kids here. I know that you wouldn't do that. But there is something about how a teenager treats a parent in the cliche form that is really how Hook treats me.
Yeah. Speaking of the kids, do you ever take acting jobs like, oh, like this will earn me some modicum of respect? I'm going to be Jude Law's friend for a few months. Maybe they'll like me more. That kind of thing.
You know, I was in Luca, and that was doing a Pixar movie. That was pretty impressive. And then I did Hotel Transylvania, and so they were impressed. But it's if you go about trying to impress your kids, it's a very brief moment.
These are little.
It's a very like, oh, that's so cool. You know that person anyway, and then
you're chasing the dragon.
Yes.
You'll never get there.
Yes.
We actually have a clip from this film. Let's take a little sneak peek at Peter Pan and Wendy and Smee.
Yes, what?
It's the boy, Captain. It's Peter Pan.
Never say his name.
Sorry, Captain.
Mr. Smee. Smee. Make a note, my cabin needs a new door.
A new door, yes. Right.
Might I say, Captain, that will be your third door this month.
And it won't be the last. Where's my telescope?
Telescope!
Smee!
Telescope adand, Captain.
Speak not to me of hands, Smee.
I see your point.
There's always the question of how hard to go into the pirate speak, right? Like how right. Hard, like the accent and the pirate talk.
Yeah.
Is that a big discussion,
Oh my gosh, it was a huge I mean, it's terrifying also doing an English accent, but also you work with a dialect coach, and supposedly the traditional pirate accent, R and all that, is a certain part of England that the original Captain Hook came from. And so that they were like, we do not want that. You can't do that voice or that accent. So then it was discovering, I mean, I didn't know there were that many. I mean, it makes sense. It's a big, it's a significant country, but I didn't know there were that many accents within England itself. And so I don't know. I think I ended up with a Midland. I don't know what I'm talking about. But it was just one of those. It was nerve-wracking because I'm doing a scene with an English person.
Yeah.
I'm my dialect coach, she was English. Ever Anderson's father is English and a director. So I'm just like, it was terrifying. And we're in Canada. So it's not, so like, you know when you go on vacation, you end up like sounding like the people? Right. That wasn't the case. it was stressful. And also, I mean, I love Dick Van Dyke, but like anyone who's watched like Mary Poppins, you're like, all right, I don't want to have that accent. Right?
Do you at this point feel as comfortable on a film set as on a stage doing stand-up?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I every set is different, and whereas stand-up, they're very different experiences, but they're equally gratifying. I mean, stand-up, there's nothing better than you have complete control.
Right.
You're the writer, director, performer. You have a microphone. The feedback is usually with laughter or silence. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And then, but I do love the experience of being part of a community and serving, even a moment is very rewarding. And so I enjoy that process a lot too. But with every movie or every acting opportunity, you're literally joining a family, and there could be crazy people in that family. So
I mean, the law of averages is there is going to be at least one.
And you don't want to be that crazy person.
Right.
And so I kind of pride myself on being the good soldier. So even when I'm, and some of it is because I had my own show and I had saw friends that I love that would show up and just behave horribly. So I knew that I didn't want to be that person.
No, did that damage relationships when like a friend comes into that environment? You're like, wait.
Well, I wouldn't say it's damaging. It's just someone has a different perspective on work professionalism. You know what I mean? Like, I think, you know, the process of acting in a project is such a communal thing, and some people don't like to work in a communal setting.
So one of the themes of the Peter Pan story in this one in particular is this push and pull with growing up, right? This fear of growing up. I'm curious, like, for you, when you were a kid, what did you imagine being an adult to be?
I would say that's, I mean, it's really interesting because with, you know, any parent, you look at your kids and these questions, you're like, what was I like at this age? What did I care about? And, but I, you know, and I see, I think that I thought that I would go out every single night. I was like, I'm going to go out to dinner every night. I'm going to stay up. I'm going to walk around and just have fun. But I did imagine that I was not somebody like, oh, I don't want to grow up. I was like, I mean, I was in a small town in Indiana, so I was like, get me out of here.
Right.
And I love Indiana, but I was like, I got to get out of here. Like, that was
clear.
Yeah.
Was that clear to, like, you were the youngest of six.
Yeah.
Were you the odd one that was the one that thought that? Like, did all the kids feel that way? Like, what?
I would say. Were you the outlier? Yeah. I mean, there was a certain affection for city life, or like, even, I remember when we would go to D.C., I loved D.C. because there were all the accents and people from different countries and you know, I like talking to strangers, and my brother, who's kind of my Irish twin, would be like, don't talk to people. So it was like, I'm one of these people that if I'm lost, I'll just go up to people like, hey, where do I go? And if any parent will tell you, that's like the worst thing you could do in front of a kid. They're like, don't do that. So, but I kind of like that in the city, that there's also a certain anonymity in large cities. You know, if you ask some stranger for directions, it's not like you're going to run into them again.
Right. Were you, in your family, were you considered the funny one? Were you, like, where the in the Gaffigan rank, the power rankings,
I mean,
comedy?
In my family, I'm considered third funniest. And
in your family unit now with the kids, you mean, or with like
among my siblings? But you know, it's a little bit. I mean, I always, my response is like, I have more comedy specials than them.
Sure.
But that's not to say that. And so, like, my brother Mitch, and by the way, my brother Mitch and my brother Joe are considered funnier. I mean, this is, what a weird family that we're sitting there doing a pecking order on who's funniest.
Let's get the chart out. But, let's do the whole.
But, because my other brother, Mike, is very funny, but, like, he's just, like, downright misanthropic. You know what I mean? So, but I do consider myself a combination of all my brothers and my sisters, too. So, it's. But yeah, I am considered third funniest. And so whenever I travel around and I do shows and I'll meet a friend or a coworker of my brother's, they always say, hey, your brother says he's funnier than you.
And wow. Never goes away.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you ever articulated to your parents that you might want to go into comedy, acting, showbiz?
Well, you know, I was... I was, I mean, there is this story that I've told where I was probably 8 or 9 and I was with my brother and we had just seen a movie that is with my mom and it was totally age inappropriate. It was about, I think it was called Obsession or something like that. It was about someone, I think Ally McGraw was in it and she died. And then her daughter grew up and she was Ally McGraw and the dad, it's kind of hard to describe, but we were at a place called Chicken Unlimited, which, because it was fancy.
Right.
And I remember my mom asked my brother and I what we wanted to be when we grew up. And my brother said he wanted to be a helicopter pilot. And I said, I wanted to be an actress. So I, you know, maybe there was some comedy in there, but I had always been, but I didn't know anyone that would do that. Like I didn't know, I mean, we didn't know anyone that was even a newscaster. Like if you saw a newscaster or knew someone that was the cousin of a newscaster, huge. That would be huge.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a realistic pursuit. The only thing close to the entertainment industry was the marching band.
Sure.
And I can't play any musical instruments. So it just seems, it just seemed like people on the East Coast or the West Coast got to be in the entertainment industry. So it wasn't realistic. But like the night before graduation from college, I admitted to a couple friends that I wanted to be a comedian. And I said, but everyone wants to do that. And I wanted to be an actor, but everyone wants to do that. And they're like, no, not everyone does. And I'm like, you're just being nice.
Like, no.
And I was like, but I still think everyone wants to be an actor comedian.
Guys, why would you want to spend a fortune right now, especially in these tough times, economically speaking, on wireless earbuds? If you lose them all the time, if you're a newbie and you don't want to like jump into a huge price point, I feel like nowadays with coffees, for instance, starting at $5, our bank accounts are always being depleted. We're entering what you can call a dupe session, right? Most products do the same thing, but they're priced differently solely based on the brand name. You're buying the brand name, not the actual product. So a good duplicate or a dupe is crucial for getting the highest quality at the best price. And that's where our sponsor Raycon comes in. Raycon wireless earbuds. You don't want to sleep on this, guys. Raycon is premium audio at the perfect price point. So you can listen to what you want, when you want, without breaking the bank. And here's the thing, guys. You're getting the quality. Over 50,000 five-star reviews. They offer free domestic shipping and flat fee international shipping. Plus, for me, water and sweat resistant. I wear these when I'm jogging, and I jog quite a bit. You need it to perform under those circumstances. Plus, you get 8 hours of playtime. That's huge to me. Noise isolation. You have customizable sound profiles. You get all the bells and whistles that you would want. Plus, they're the right price. They offer buy now, pay later options. Right now, you can pay as low as $18 at checkout. So guys, here's my offer to you. buyraycon.com/HSC. That's the place to go today to get 15% off your Raycon order. That's buyraycon.com/HSC to score 15% off. buyraycon.com/HSC.
So you move here, 1990.
Yeah.
Had you already been doing stand-up by then? Like, what was the dream goal when you arrive in New York City?
Was I studied finance in school, and then I moved to Tampa, had a job that I was horrible at, and then a friend of mine from college helped me get a job in advertising. But I always knew that I wanted to go to New York, and I remember thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do, but New York will help me figure it out. And so I moved to New York. I worked in an advertising agency, Gray Advertising. I worked on the Procter & Gamble floor. I now know that in hindsight, I was kind of the token goy. Because I was Everyone was Jewish, and then there was me, and they were just kind of, people would mess with me. They'd be like, all right, someone would call me and go get the schlep bag. And I'd be like, all right. And so then I'd ask people, where's the schlep bag? And they're like, it's a portfolio. They're messing with you. And so, but I had this great fear of public speaking. And so, like, essentially in a meeting, I'd have an idea and I would just get all flustered and, you know, I'm around grown men and women and they're like, what is wrong? So it was like, we now know it's anxiety, but like right. At that point, they're like, why don't you do like public speaking or Toastmakers or something? So I did an improv class and then someone was doing a stand-up seminar kind of, thing. And so I did that. And then that's, I did stand-up and I've been addicted ever since.
So talk to me a little bit about, the 90s, basically, yeah. Portion of your career in New York. That's a period where you're finding your voice, as it were, trying yes. out different kind of personas. Maybe that's too strong a word, but
yeah,
but
yeah,
trying definitely. To figure out who you were on stage.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think that I was also trying to figure out who I moved right. to New York thinking, I was in the Midwest. I'm like, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm not Midwestern. I'm supposed to be in New York. So then I get to New York and everyone's like, you're the most Midwestern looking person I've ever seen in my life. Right. And I was like, really? And so
I'm the cool one back home.
I thought I was the urban guy.
Right.
And so then so in stand-up, you know, to set it up, you have to understand, in the early 90s, this is before YouTube. This is really the beginning of Comedy Central.
Is this like alt comedy scene? Like
it
is that
was,
around that?
It was before that. There was very much, stand-up was combat in some ways. So there was not... and it was a lot of, so there had been an 80s comedy boom, so, and then it went bust where like all these clubs closed, and so there were too many comedians, and there was a lot of, if you had great confidence and you could deal, so like audiences didn't know how to perform necessarily, how to behave, so they would heckle,
yeah.
They would, essentially, they'd behave like people in Long Island behave right now. No, I'm joking, I love Long Island. And so, but there was an element of combat,
yeah.
And there was like, so people would, in the early 90s, they're like, all right, so I see Rodney Dangerfield on The Tonight Show, people yell at him and he responds, I'll do that. I've seen Andrew Dice Clay. This is what he, you know, it's a little bit of, I'm helping by yelling.
Right. This right? is what is and expected. So, I'm not, yeah.
And so it was much more of combat.
So wait, how did you handle that?
Some of it is, I was terrified. But one of the things that I did is that because I'm a slow talking Midwesterner, I just would never stop talking. And then also I developed this thing where I would talk for the audience. So I would say a joke, and then instead of someone heckling me, I would heckle myself. And so that's, that's weird, why is he doing that? So that's where that came from, is so that I would always be talking, and that, you know, going on stage in the early 90s looking like the nephew of John Tesh, was like, people were like, who is this guy? You know what I mean? And so I had to address it. And because people, and so that's some of where the inside voice and some of the, the self-deprecation is just low self-esteem, but it is also addressing that, communicating right. to the audience that you're aware of how you come across and what you, and by the way, stand-up comedy is now much more of a college-educated profession. In the early 90s, not so much.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? In the early 90s, it was like people that can't afford therapy. Do you know what I mean? It was, do you know what I'm saying? It was yeah. much more, like there was no expectation that, no expectation that you would be able to make a living doing stand-up. For every Roseanne or Seinfeld, there was not necessarily every city in America even had a comedy club at that point. Now we live in an age where comedians are performing in theaters and arenas and can afford to have five kids in New York City. Right. That was not the case.
And what did like your fellow comedians back then make of you? Because look, you've been labeled for good or for bad as like the clean comic, right, yeah, over the years. And like, did you have the respect of your peers that like that was, you were staying true to yourself, that was your lane? And
well, some of it is, it's you know, like the whole clean comedian thing, which comes down to, you know, what I think people like about comedians is a certain amount of authenticity. And so when I would try on different kind of personas, you know, I'm still a big fan of Dave Attell. I wanted to be like Dave Attell, but the reality is that people don't want to see an angry, grumpy white guy, really. You know what I mean? They're like, that guy is like my boss, or I've seen in history books, that means bad news. You know what I mean? So right. Some of it is authenticity and also what works for you.
Yeah.
And so I do think that, so discovering the authenticity, but also comedians kind of do the comedy that they can do. It's not some grand plan. Like, if you know David Cross, that his stand-up is exactly the stand-up he should be doing. If you know Lewis Black, you know, he's not yelling.
No, these
all
are
the
refined
time.
Or
but he
accentuated
is,
versions.
He has
yeah.
very
yeah.
passionate beliefs.
Yeah.
And so the authenticity is, you got to discover that so that it's kind of, you can access the material. Because if you're pretending or putting on a different character, it's not sustainable. I say that, and I'm sure like in the next 6 months, there'll be like a great example that proves that wrong. But
so before we get to what I think was probably a major turning point in 99 for you for stand-up, we'll get there in a second. But in those 90s years, you're acting. You're trying to get parts where you can.
Yeah.
I noticed, do you know how many roles you played on Law & Order in different incarnations over the years?
Well, you know, any New York actor, that's, you know.
Jim Gaffigan has been five different characters on Law & Order over
yeah.
the years.
Yeah, that's... But that was, I mean, for a New York actor, that was, I mean, I also love Law & Order, and,
right.
But that was such a great credit to have. And it was, you know, it's weird, because there was, you know, there was a time when, you know, before streaming, where that was the equivalent of streaming, was just watching Law & Order
yes.
reruns,
yes.
right?
Yes, yes.
That was the original streamer.
Do you remember any of your characters from Law & Order, if I named one?
I think so. I know that I played a guy, Larry Johnson, and then in Super Troopers, I was also named Larry Johnson.
Oh, okay. It's a good name.
Which is very weird.
Yes, you were on Law & Order 98, you were George Rosakis.
Oh, yes.
SVU, this one seems a little bit upsetting.
Yeah.
You were Oliver Tunney. Do you know who Oliver Tunney was? You remember that character?
Oh, that guy was a bad... He was a clown...
Pedophile, yeah.
But everyone on... Not to downplay it. You know what I mean? But it is like...
Yeah.
It is weird, because you'd think, like, you really want to act that bad? You know what I mean? It's like, oh, it's a great role. You know, it's so...
Yeah.
It's so weird.
Yeah. Then you were a crematorium owner, Russell Matthews on Criminal Intent, and Marty Palin. You were Marty Palin on Criminal
Yeah, is that the guy that killed his wife?
They probably all did, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. Okay, so let's talk about what seemingly was a huge moment for you. Indiana Kid looks
yeah.
up to, of course,
oh, yeah.
Mr. David Letterman.
Yeah, it was a huge, it was the primary goal for a long time was, all right, if I can get on Letterman, then I have a credit. Because, you know, it's interesting because there was a time when The Tonight Show or Letterman were...
Overnight would change you, right?
It would transform, you know, it would, for generations, I mean, or decades, it really changed careers. But it was, for me, it was a credibility thing. So like if you said you were a comedian, there wasn't a question of, do you have a Netflix special? It was like, have you been on Letterman or The Tonight Show? And if you hadn't, people would say, you should try and get on there. Like as if, as a comedian, Thanks, you didn't know. And so, but it's always shifting. So like even, you know, what we call a Netflix special, in 5 years, they might call it a YouTube special because there's a shift in how important any platform is for building a career. And I don't know, I've seen so many changes in stand-up over the
years. Have you thought about, like, if you were coming up now, would you have been able to navigate? I mean, there are more opportunities in a way, as you're saying. Like, you don't have to, there isn't that one get on Tonight Show, get on Letterman. But at the same time, there are so many more folks trying their hand at stand-up now, it's seemingly.
Yeah, it's huge. But, and also, like, the impact of podcasts.
Right.
You know, so there's podcasts and TikTok stars that, but I also have been around long enough to know that, like, there is, you know, it's like, does it last after 5 years?
Right.
And that's the consistency thing. That's where we all know who Jerry Seinfeld is. And even independent of the fact that he's had these incredible shows, it is the consistency, the relevance of his humor and him adjusting that humor over decades. That's pretty impressive.
I don't know what the last time you saw this was, but we have a clip from your appearance on Letterman back in 1999.
Oh, my gosh.
Are you ready to take a peek?
I'm very thin.
Let's take a look.
This man regularly performs at the Gotham Comedy Club right here in New York City. Please welcome the very funny Jim Gaffigan. Jim!
It is good to be here. I am originally from Indiana, and I know what most of you are thinking. Indiana Mafia. There's a different kind of pride where I'm from, you know? It's not like, we're from New York, we're tough, or we're from Texas, we like things big. It's more like, we're from Indiana, and we're gonna move. You know, the reason I look like this is because my father was from Sweden and my mother was Elton John. Yeah, I trust people with glasses, don't you? It's like, well, ask him, he's got glasses. But if you're wearing your glasses like this, get away from him! Would you ever take directions from someone that looks like us? Where you gotta go? 53rd Street? Well, why don't we take my spaceship? I gotta pick up Santa Claus anyway. You know, the only advantage of wearing glasses is that dramatic removal. You ever see that? My God. Holy.
Still laughing at the material. Oh, that's a good sign.
Well, that's great. That's great.
Does that take you back? I mean, do you remember? Were you nervous? You didn't seem seemingly.
Well, I was. I was definitely. Well, the weird thing is I had like I started stand up, and this was 7 or 8 years after I had started, and every single one of my peers had done the equivalent of this. So I was like the last one. So there was part of me that was like, I'm ready, you know, and it's in a weird way, it was kind of like, all right, a relief that I've gotten this. And also the fact that Letterman is from Indiana and I'm from Indiana and and growing up, I would see him on TV and I'm like, wait, he got out? I can get out. But it was, yeah. So it was like one of those things where I was not the first of my peer group to get there.
Right.
So I had friends that were like, oh yeah, this is what you do. You talk slow, you know, so I was talking slow.
So we don't have time to go into every part of the career since then, because it's been a while. It's been 24 years, I guess, since then. But like, you got a sitcom off of that, and clearly it did jumpstart the career. Did it have the effect you thought it was going to have? Like,
yeah, I mean, well, some of it is the night of this performance, which I had no expectation. So I had always had this as a goal. Right afterwards, the executive producer said they're like, the executive producer wants to talk to you. And I thought, oh, cool. Maybe they'll want me to write for the show. And then they were like, they want to develop a show. And what was kind of instantaneous was if Letterman thought I was good, then suddenly all these people that had ignored me, I think I had just been in LA meetings like 2 weeks before that, and people were like, yeah, we're not interested. And those same people were like, now we are interested. So it was a hugely significant thing because the entertainment industry, it's perception. Yes. And what people don't realize is the entertainment industry is very risk averse. It's like, I know that we think that they're just throwing money around, but like, it's an investment, and they don't want to put money behind a horse that's not going to finish the race.
It's so funny, because literally on the stage like about a week ago, the other best example I can think of from like that Letterman effect, Ray Romano was here.
Yeah.
And
oh yeah.
You guys both, it changed your lives.
Yeah.
So in reading about you over the years, like, it seems like you have two passions in your life, which are, I mean, you're a workaholic. You're
either that or feel feelings.
There's that. But the family is obviously a huge thing to you, as it should be. But like, those two passions can obviously, and often do for folks, conflict. And for a true workaholic, how have you managed that? What's the secret sauce for you to kind of keep to both boats afloat?
Well, I mean, I would say it's a constant, wait a minute, so what are the two, you're saying my family and my career.
Yeah.
It's like, it would be sad if I was like, what's the other one?
career I got, what's the other one again?
Well, I would say it is a constant reevaluation, right? And I would say that it's every couple months, like, okay, well, we have to slow down. We have to do this. Or we have to, you know, if we're going to do this, we have to construct it where everyone goes. And as children get older, it becomes way more complicated. And, but I would say it's constantly reevaluating. That being said, I am a parent, so I am filled with guilt. But I also, I do think that it's important for your children to see you work hard. Yeah. And I would say, I don't play golf. I'm not going out to dinner. Often when I do stand up in the city, I can do stuff, you know, beforehand. Like, I never had dinner with my dad. I have dinner with my family, and then I go out and do a show, and then I get my kids to bed, and then I yell at them to wake up and stuff like that. You know, it's hard. Parenting is very hard, and it makes no sense living in New York City, but I love it.
I'm a New York City kid. I came out semi-okay. It can happen.
I think your generation, yeah.
We're going to go to some audience questions in a second, but before we do that, I've got the Happy, Sad, Confused, Profoundly Random questionnaire for Jim Gaffigan.
Okay, great.
Ready? What's the wallpaper on your phone?
My 13-year-old daughter. Okay. She's my middle kid, so it's like, see, I do care.
Do you have a favorite T-shirt that you own?
Whatever fits over my gut. You know.
Would you ever skydive?
No. That's not necessary. It's just, no.
It's the last actor you were mistaken for.
It's always Philip Seymour Hoffman. Oh. You know, which is a great compliment.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is consistent. And people always think they're the first one to notice it. They're like, I just realized this. I don't know if you know that your coloring and your gigantic jug head look like Philip Seymour Hoffman. I'm like, I know, thank you.
What's the most annoying thing about you, according to your kids, to your wife? What's the common theme?
Oh, well, I mean, I think it's a different thing. I would say to my kids is that I'm a motivator. Like, I don't, I'm much more strict and kind of like an army general, kind of like, you know, what you should do is you should do this or that. And I would say that the most annoying thing, my wife would probably say that she's annoyed that I can nap and she can't.
Oh, yeah.
Good, some people are nappers and some people can't.
Yeah. No.
And I would have jumped out of a building if I can't nap.
In the spirit of happy, sad, confused, an actor or comedian that makes you happy always, without fail. You see them on screen, see them on stage.
Oh, I don't know. John Candy? I mean, always pretty much. Yeah. Or Jonathan Winters always makes me happy.
Great. A movie that makes you sad?
Wow. You know, like, I like movies where, you know, you get kind of caught off guard. Like, It's a Wonderful Life. Like, at the end of It's a Wonderful Life, I'm always a little bit like, oh, I gotta go and do something.
right.
But, and so, yeah, I love dramas. I love sad songs. That's kind of, you know, that's what I consume mostly. So the stuff that catches me off guard is stuff that really gets me. And that's usually the, you know, like It's a Wonderful Life. It's the emotion of like...
The cumulative effect of
this guy realizing how important his family is, that the community is showing up for him, that stupid, his uncle isn't going to ruin his life.
Right. Just spoiled It's a Wonderful Life for folks. No. Wow. and a food that makes you confused?
Food that makes me confused? Honestly, I've always wanted to like salmon. I've always wanted to.
Yeah.
And it just, I know I should like it. Yeah. I know that. But like fish in general, just I don't know what's going on. I mean, I'm not talking about fish and chips. I mean, that's like French fries. Sure. Yeah. But like,
well, you fry anything. It's okay. You deep fry anything.
Yeah, but fish in general, like, I'm going to do shows in Scandinavia. I'm like, I don't know what you guys are doing with all this fish. But I wish, I'm too white trash, I think, to really get on the fish train. But salmon, I wish I liked it. There's a lot of benefits. People love salmon. You know, it's like a salmon steak, you know. You put it on a bagel, you know, all this stuff. I want to join, yeah. But it's disgusting.
No. It's good to know yourself. I'm sure this audience has some questions. If you want to just raise your hands, we can start right here. Go ahead.
Fellow Hoya, so I have to ask, what was your Georgetown experience like? I know you were on the football team.
Yes.
No,
there was no.
Everybody?
There was no. My daughter goes there, and now there's all these theater programs. There was Mask and Bauble. I don't know if you when you graduated, but there was Cabaret, which was that going on when you were there? It was this thing at college where all the people that were singers would sing songs, just covers, and every year they would have a host and. And it was usually someone comedic, and that was the first time I did it. Did like stand up, and I did comedy bits, and I was reviewed by the school papers. There was the Hoya, and then the Voice, and just decimated, horrible reviews. And I sat behind the woman in statistics, and I'm like, "What are you doing? Why are you burying me?" But I was drunk, and she was like, "He was just drunk."
Well,
so. But that was my experience. It was a touch of the entertainment industry, but I mean, I loved it, but you know, at the end, I was like, get me out of here, you know.
All right, let's go. Yeah, yes, sir.
Fellow with a lot of your Lakers.
Oh, there you go.
Did you hone your skills in the backwoods of Indiana?
You know, I would say that at Lalamere, I mean, we went to this school that Chief Justice John Roberts went to.
Okay.
Even though Supreme Court not as high status as it used to be. But I would say that it was such, I mean, there was 100 kids in the school, and there was 25 in my graduating class, and there were 4 girls. And I was voted funniest and best body, believe it or not. Male body. But, I mean, at my high school, I think that every single one of the kids that went there was was kind of taught this, you can do anything kind of thing, that you kind of hope that you would learn, right? And that, and all I wanted when I was at Lalamere was to go to Georgetown, and I applied, and I didn't get in. And so it was like, but that incredible rejection, that was one of those moments where I think it was so instructive, because at that time I was like, well, what do I mean, I literally had a dog named Hoya. My parents had a dog named Hoya, but it was one of those moments where I could either kind of, feel sorry for myself, but I transferred in. So it was, rejection was a great lesson. Now it sounds like I'm leading a self-help course.
Did you have, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So do you have any advice for somebody who wants to, like, write comedy?
Well, here's what I would say. You're starting too late. No. But what I would say, it's, because I have a 17-year-old son that's very funny, and what I would say is that there's skills of learning how to write and performing, and I don't think that any time you write down, and writing styles can shift, you can write by hand, you can type on a computer, you can write down, you can do it audio. But some of, and I've seen this throughout my entire career, that some of it is how you process rejection and humiliation. I know that sounds really ridiculous, but like, if you know that it's like, all right, there's going to be some jokes that don't work. There's going to be times when you audition or you interview for a job and it's humiliating. There's going to be a girl that you ask out that says no, or it's like, it's that kind of develops a certain amount of grit, because everyone that I know in the entertainment industry, either they're just kind of like a robot and it doesn't affect them, or they develop a certain amount of calluses to process rejection. So I would say write as much as you can and get an appetite for humiliation.
I have a follow-up there. How do you stay sharp when there's less rejection? Like, for you, by now, career-wise, I mean, people are predisposed. They're excited to see you now. And you're getting, obviously, Soderbergh. Like, you're working with amazing filmmakers. So how...
But it's also all self-assignment, right?
Right.
So it's like... I'm certainly not comparing myself to like Stephen King, but it's like, he doesn't need to write all those books. He already
good.
Wrote them.
You're good,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like, it's also, but it's enjoying the process, right? And so, but it is self-assignment. So that being said, it's enjoying it, but also if you don't set a goal, like if you don't sit there and go, I'm going to do a show, I think we should all put pressure on this kid. If I'm not going to do stand-up at Gotham Comedy Club in the next 6 months, that's on me.
Wow.
And then you set that goal, And then, are you sitting with your mom? And then she'll call up and she'll set it up and you'll do it and you'll go up and you'll do 2 minutes. And you do it because you set a goal and you do it, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, you know what that kid ended up being? That kid ended up being Jimmy Fallon.
Single teardrop. Amazing. I'm back there. Yeah, go ahead.
What's your favorite place for late
night food? Oh my gosh, there's so many. So here in New York? I love a burger, but it varies, right? Like, I love, and I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, because, like, whenever I post on this, they're like, you spelled it wrong. You know what I mean? But Mamoun's, which there's one near the Comedy Cell and there's one on St. Mark's, is,
from Mamoun's.
And shawarma. It's like, you feel less guilty. You feel less likely you're going to feel nauseous the next day.
Right.
But I would say, I love doing stand-up when I'm on the road and then going eating a steak and, not telling my wife. Because that's the whole thing, is you can't be out having fun.
Right.
And your spouse is trapped with children. But I'll have a steak. So I... late night, there's so many things, but I try to mix it up. I think that's the important thing.
Just no salmon. Yep.
Yes.
Sir, on the side, yeah.
Hi. This is a two-parter. Am I correct in remembering that you had long hair when you first got to the city?
I had hair. I don't think long, because I was an account person in advertising, so I don't think I could have.
Longer.
Well, definitely longer. But not like, I wasn't Billy Ray Cyrus.
But. Okay. We cleared up the hair. Go over here, yeah, please.
Bruce Springsteen's biggest hit is Born to Run. It put him on the map.
Yeah.
Is Hot Pockets your Born to Run?
Play Hot Pockets, play Hot
Yeah. It is, I don't know, it's weird because there is something of, I guess.
You do it as an encore sometimes, don't you?
I used to. I stopped.
Okay.
But there is something, again, it's like the entertainment industry is all perception. So, I would do it as an encore, and the whole other show would have been new material. And sure. People would be like, he did some new stuff, he did some old stuff. And so it's, and after you've worked so hard on, but the Hot Pocket thing, it's weird, but I feel like it's diminishing. That's very flattering to be compared to Bruce Springsteen. But, it's weird. I don't think, Hot Pockets aren't as important as they used to, right?
Let's go all the way in the back. Yes.
This is more an observation. I listened to you with my wife and my kids, and you have improved our relationship. Because it's like, you tell these terrific stories, and we all laugh together, and we're in the car. And then afterwards, I can connect with my kids in a way that I never did before. So thank you.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. I think we have time for about, let's go.
Who
do you think was more starstruck, you by meeting the Pope or the Pope by meeting you?
Well, that's a tough one. The Pope had no idea who I was.
Didn't mention the Hot Pockets.
There was a guy behind him speaking in Italian or Spanish. And he was like, and so the Pope would be like, who's this guy? And so there was someone like, Comedica Americana. And so he was like, But I got my mother-in-law, who is a very devout Catholic, already admitted to heaven, still alive. But I got her to meet the Pope, so I won best son-in-law ever.
You did it. We're wrapping up, but I do want to say you've been to 92nd Street Y before. We're always privileged to have you here celebrating the 150th anniversary.
Unbelievable.
NY. So, do you have, hopefully you have more fond memories after tonight, but what do you think, as a New Yorker, what do you think 92nd Street Y means to New York?
Well, it is such a, my kids, we were talking about the preschool, right? And how I had kids at Avenues, and I still have one there. And the reason we chose Avenues is because they had poached the person from the 92nd Street Y. And so it was like, all right, we got to follow her. And so the impact of 92nd Street NY now is so huge. And it's just, even from a conversation earlier, I had no idea the sheer consistency of that importance. Like, I knew that when I moved to New York, that it was this very important cultural landmark where important, you know, conversations occurred. And it was very, you know, kind of like a pie in the sky idea that I would be able to, you know, talk there, be interviewed, or anything like that. But it's most impressive, the consistency over that span of time.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, I, you know, McSorley's has been around for a while. But
those are the two.
But it's,
yeah,
you know, it's filled with drunks. Yeah.
Well, you're a cultural landmark in New York now too. So we appreciate having you always. I should mention, yes. Peter Pan and Wendy, to come full circle, Disney Plus, check it out. Honestly, it's a great piece of work from Jim and a great filmmaker, David Lowery. You're touring, you're about to go to Europe, yes?
Yes.
And it just never ends.
Yeah, no, it's, I look forward to it, but I used to be much more excited about international travel. Now I'm like, jet lag. Now I'm complaining about going to Europe. That's how far I've come.
Well, we'll get you back to New York. And like I said, you've got some amazing projects. You've been directed by Jerry Seinfeld and Steven Soderbergh in the last year.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
That's fun.
We'll talk about that more another time. Let's give it up one more time for the great Mr. Jim Gaffigan, everybody.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.